Welcome to the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast, where we discuss the world of IT and cybersecurity. Don't be left in the dark about what is going on in the world around you. Here is your host, Joe Gray.
Welcome to another episode of the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast. I'm Joe Gray. With me this stunning evening is Tracy Mayleaf. You may know her as the InfoSec Sherpa. She is your guide up a mountain of information. She's making her break into information security. She's already contributed a chapter to the Peerless book. She's a researcher, a speaker, a blogger. Her background is in library science. She worked in the library of several law offices for quite some period of time. She's received awards from Thomson Reuters, Dow Jones, and others. With that being said, she now runs Sherpa Intelligence, LLC, and basically she works on information security and competitive intelligence and OSINT. It wouldn't be advanced persistent security without it, to help her clients gain the information and insight to build the strategy that they're looking for. With that being said, how's it going, Tracy?
It's going great. Thanks so much for having me back.
Always a pleasure. You are welcome every time. And before we get started, just know that the thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of my employers or Tracy's employers, past, present, or future. Now that that's out of the way, we have to mention that Tracy is a member of the PVCSec podcast. If you're in the market for another information security podcast with a different angle, by all means, check them out. More to come about that later on in the show.
I'm contractually obligated to plug PVCSec.
There you have it. And I'm just obligated because I like you guys.
And you will be our guest on our recording tomorrow.
Well, you just let the cat out of the bag.
Spoiler alert.
Meow.
Anyway, with that being said, did I leave anything out in your introduction?
No, that's pretty, pretty clear the past, few years. Yeah, that's, I was a librarian. I caught the security bug, and now I'm here, and I'm living the dream. I quit my job in February this year, and I've been working as Sherpa Intelligence ever since and loving life.
Awesome. I definitely understand the liberated feeling you get in a new career, a challenging career, and something you love. So, for a not quite so easy transition into a somewhat difficult topic, I want to take a moment and discuss the wildfires in the Smoky Mountains of eastern Tennessee. This also affects parts of Georgia, Virginia, and North Carolina. There's a pretty significant wildfire burning there right now. So I've got a blog post up. I will put it in the show notes. But basically, it's to help raise money for those affected by the wildfires. There's some families that have lost absolutely everything. And, this is a difficult time of year to begin with. So in reality, it's one of those things that we kind of need to band together and look out for the community as a whole. So without going down the entire list of everything, here's a quick overview of things you can do right now. So first and foremost, you can text Red Cross to 90999. That will bill $10 on your phone bill and it will donate to the American Red Cross. Additionally, you can call Citizens National Bank at area code 865-453-9031 and ask to donate to the City of Pigeon Forge Fire Relief Fund. The Seymour Volunteer Fire Department has a donation website up. There's a couple of other outlets that I haven't updated the blog with yet. The one I can think of is the Anderson County Animal Shelter. They're helping out with Sevier County, which is where Gatlinburg, Sevierville, and Pigeon Forge are. So with that being said, consider donating if you can. If you can't, I understand. Just share if you feel so compelled. So that's basically the end of my rant on that. Tracy, do you have anything to add?
No, I mean, it's definitely a dire situation. I saw some photos and definitely give what you can. And I did look up, since I have a library background, I'm always curious to know what happened to the libraries during events like this of natural disasters. And I did learn that the Sevier, is that how it's pronounced? Sevier County Library System is collecting toiletries, and they're waiving late fees for people affected. So if you forget everything that Joe said about where to donate, you can also just contact the library because they're accepting donations.
Yes, that's very true. And two things to go off of that before we transition. First and foremost, if you're in the Eastern Tennessee area, basically everybody and their brother is accepting donations. I've seen outlets as far away as Chattanooga accepting donations to send up to Sevier County. And secondly, you know, I'm going to admit I got caught with my pants down. I shared a photo in the blog post earlier and come to find out it was not a photo from the wildfires. Since then, I have updated the blog post to have a fire that, unfortunately, I can verify is legitimate. I've seen this very scene, but just know that, yes, I did share a photo that I thought was part of the wildfires, but it turned out to not be part of it, and I was corrected quickly on Twitter. Since then, I've made all required updates. So, just to get that out of the way, are you ready to go ahead and kick it off?
Let's do this thing.
Cool. So our first story, it's actually coming from Forbes. Both of our stories actually are coming from Forbes. This one, I was talking about Bletchley Park. It's opening up for a cybersecurity school in the United Kingdom. So give us a little bit of history about Bletchley Park.
Oh, well, it was the code-cracking institution during World War II. If you're familiar with the movie The Imitation Game, that was Bletchley Park. And it's where Alan Turing worked, and you know, obviously know about Alan Turing and all that he did with the Turing machine. So that was really the brain center of code cracking of the UK government and during World War II. And it's historical and it's very important to the security, you know, the cybersecurity community. And now they're starting this not-for-profit college for cybersecurity, which I believe my comment when I first saw the news was, I want to go to there. And somebody else commented, said, how about if we pitch them on being instructors for the school? And I said, that works too. I just think that this is a great thing to be a part of. I'm glad to see this happening. And where else better to have this at Bletchley Park? I mean, the history there is just overwhelming. So good on you, United Kingdom, for, you know, for putting this there. Now, with a lot of the privacy issues, the Snoopers Charter was actually passed in the UK, so I'm kind of curious now how some of the legislation going on in the UK is going to affect the cybersecurity school, if at all.
Absolutely. And, you know, to shout out to some of our friends across the pond, you know, Jenny Radcliffe, Sarah Clark, Graham Cluley, if you guys want to organize a security conference to take place at Bletchley Park, I might just be able to make my way across the pond, and I'm sure I could probably speak for Tracy and say that she would make an honest attempt to attend as well.
I don't know that it's that easy that you can just call and reserve a spot, but...
Well, I'm not putting them on the spot or anything, but if anybody could make it happen, it would probably be those three.
Well, but listen, if they want to have a gin conference and maybe some cybersecurity talk breaks out, then I'm good with that too. Hashtag GinfoSec.
Hashtag GingerSec.
That's something else entirely.
Okay. Anyway, so with this, you know, you hit the nail on the head with everything. You know, I'm a big fan of The Imitation Game. I'm a big fan of Alan Turing. I may or may not have used Alan Turing's name in a bogus Gmail account name to spam a list back in the day. But either way, and the funny thing is it was a security list and they didn't get the whole Alan Turing name. So it's pretty funny.
Interesting. But yeah, so it was actually purchased by the government, that whole complex, in 1938. And it actually reopened in 1993 as a museum. And so yeah, it's interesting. So they've definitely preserved their history of cybersecurity in the UK, but I find it fascinating and just a really smart move that they're using it for instruction.
Absolutely.
And now that I think about it, it's like, oh wow, like they should have done that sooner. But you know, who knew how this was, you know, this industry was going to really explode. So you know, so good on them. That sounds good, and I'm very curious to keep an eye on that to see how that evolves. You know, I'm curious to see who applies for that. Is that the kind of school where it's going to be, you know, traditional, quote unquote, traditional age college students? Is it going to be for professionals going back? I'm really curious to see what they do with it.
They could even use it as a training ground for their military, for that matter. But you know, I would venture to guess that part of what may be triggering this could be either the cybers, Russia could be a trigger, or the 400-pound hackers in their parents' basement, you know? Could be any of the above.
True, but I have to look a little further at the question that I raised for myself, because now I'm curious about the whole Snoopers Charter and how that might affect, how that's going to affect the country in general, and then see how this whole College of Cybersecurity is going to function, if they're going to focus on certain things and how that's going to work. But, I mean, to learn cybersecurity at the home of the Enigma machine is pretty cool, pretty darn cool. And if I can also just give, it's not Bletchley Park, but the version of Bletchley Park in the U.S., I actually have a personal connection to. I don't know if you knew that about me, Joe.
I believe you may have mentioned it, but let's go ahead and tell the audience.
So, if you know your American military history, there was a station called Vint Hill Farms in rural Virginia, and that was one of the original top secret cryptology and intelligence schools that the Army started. And my uncle was one of the original 16 students who was admitted to that school, and he worked for the U.S. Army Signal Corps and did things with cryptology during World War II. And only very recently, to the best of my knowledge, that it was recent, that a lot of this was declassified. So we had a family gathering over the summer, and he was telling us things that he wasn't, I know that he wasn't able to tell us before, because he made the announcement of, okay, I got word that such and such has been declassified, so I can tell you now. And he's in his 90s, and I remember, so I can tell you a story that I remember when I was very young, went to go visit him and my aunt. They lived in Virginia, and I remember laying on the living room floor coloring, and he had the Redskins game on, and I was coloring. I just remember saying, tell me a story from World War II. And he didn't take his eyes off the Redskins game, and he just said, you don't have the security clearance. And I thought he was just kind of being, making an uncle joke or something like that. And I looked at him, and I looked up from my coloring, and I said, no, come on, I want to hear a story from World War II. And he took his eyes off the TV, and he looked at me, and he, not in a mean way, but in a very, military stern way, he looked at me and he said, no, seriously, you don't have the security clearance for me to tell you a story from what I did in World War II. So that was when I was, I think, 10 years old. So, hearing this past summer, a lot of the things that he was involved with, and actually I'm learning a lot, not from him, but from articles, because he's been the recipient of certificates of appreciation from various veterans groups for what he did. One of the things that his group was involved with was intercepting messages that had to do with D-Day. And, he actually met General Amar Bradley and, was personally thanked by him. And there was a lot of things he also did on the West Coast involving intercepting Japanese messages. So he did a lot of really cool stuff, and I'm very proud of him. And fortunately, he is still with us. So I'm hoping to still get some more stories out of him, before he passes on. But he did a lot of really cool stuff, and I'm really proud of my uncle, and I just wanted to plug that since we were talking about Bletchley Park and World War II.
Excellent. Hats off, by all means. And to provide a little bit of update about Vent Hills Farm, it was actually closed as part of the base realignment and closure in 2013. It was closed in 1997. It kind of continued for a little bit. 2013 actually is when a Cold War museum opened on the property, and it's only opened on weekends, but it's worth taking a look at. There's also a winery, a brewery, a gymnastics school on the property as well, according to the Wikipedia for it. As soon as you mentioned it,
as soon as
you said Virginia, I thought you were going to say the farm.
Oh no! Well, I do have a funny story about that though. He told us over the summer. He said that. I don't remember when he did this, but he said that on different times during his life, since he retired as a major in the Army, he said that the NSA brought him to their facility to talk to the new students, and he said basically they would tell, like, him and some of the other retired servicemen would tell them stories of how they used to do things. And I guess, you know, to compare it with what they're learning now. And he said basically they would just be laughing at, you know, how, you know, how simplistic things were and how they used to do things. But yeah, he said that he's, you know, he's been to Fort Meade to, you know, to give talks and things like that. And I think that was probably a while ago. But yeah, I mean, I remember also hearing vaguely something maybe 20 years ago. He made some offhand comment of, he's like, you know, oh, you know, I, there used to be a day when I could just, you know, I could just go into the Pentagon or something like that. So that for whatever clearance he had. So, yeah, I'm glad to hear that they did something with it to preserve it. And that's all very cool. Nice.
Excellent. So let's go ahead and transition to the next story. As usual, it wouldn't be the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast without mentioning something about social engineering or phishing. So basically, this article came out that's talking about what you need to know about cybersecurity and phishing attacks. And it appears to be on the heels of the election, which that's a rabbit hole that's already been hit. We don't need to talk about the election. It's over. It's done with. And I, quite frankly, just don't want to be controversial. So with that being said, though, it has come out that one of the main vectors in the DNC email attack was a phishing email to John Podesta. Actually, several phishing emails. Do you want to go over the article really quickly, and then I'll go over the basic advice and kind of break that down?
Sure. Well, I mean, the article just really rehashed everything that happened with the DNC hack, and it's the person who wrote it was also writing it as giving advice. So just things that we all know and heard before about updating passwords, you know, well, actually the advice is literally update your passwords regularly and use different characters and symbols each time, which is very simplistic, but I guess for the audience this is written for. You know, and then the next set of advice given is set up security questions and answers that hackers can't guess based on your public information. So things that can't be obtained via OSINT. I guess it's just easier to make up nonsense, you know, to be really secure. And then the last one is, you know, avoid downloading suspicious links and delete your cookies every month. Now, the suspicious links, again, you know, how does one determine that, especially if you're not, you know, not in the world that we're in, where, you know, we're maybe a little bit more suspicious of links, and that's what a whole phishing thing is. So I don't, it doesn't actually say in here what exactly Podesta clicked on, but that's a whole other discussion in of itself, is, you know, how does a layperson, quote unquote, really know if something is suspicious? There's a couple ways, but the scammers are getting smarter at sending those out there. So that's, you know, you're really gonna have to think about things. And I think I've mentioned this before, is I know attorneys usually give a lot of pushback on not downloading attachments from people they don't know and stuff like that, because attorneys, for example, might get a potential client emailing them and will have documents and things like that. So I remember when I was at the law firm, that was always an argument that they would give, is, well, if I didn't open emails from people I don't know, I wouldn't have any clients. So it's kind of convoluted, but that's basically, it was just written from the perspective of this person who gives advice to people. And also with cyber, you know, Monday, just on this week, there was a lot of emails floating around about making sure that you weren't, needlessly clicking on things that were fake Cyber Monday sales. And I saw some numbers about how the overwhelming majority of Black Friday and Cyber Monday sales were actually made on mobile devices. So then that goes into a whole other rabbit hole of, you know, were people using public Wi-Fi? You know, did people get, you know, were they sending information over, you know, Wi-Fi at Starbucks while they were shopping for things? So that's kind of the gist of the article.
Absolutely agree. And basically, here's my take on it. So I don't know about suspicious links, but I know if I'm looking at a malicious link, he's bald-headed and named Jerry.
Ba-dum-bum.
I had to do it. With that being said, though, I understand why they're saying delete your cookies every month, but I don't understand why you should be waiting until the, you know, doing it once a month. You should be doing it routinely if that's what you're doing, because, you know, attackers can steal your cookie via a cross-site scripting attack. They can do all kinds of wonderfully malicious things with it, but every month, I would be curious to know where he got that threshold from.
Well, I have an idea, just because when you're talking to, again, quote-unquote lay people, you kind of need to give some direction. You know, if you just say to someone that this is very foreign to, you know, you just say periodically, they're going to be like, well, what does that mean? So I think it was just, he might even agree with you that, you know, that more often is better. But I think, again, this article was written for lay people. So I think giving them something concrete, like, you know, like a month, is something that they can wrap their minds around and understand, rather than having some, you know, nebulous language. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And, you know, with regards to the passwords, and again, this is a little bit more advanced than your absolute most general layperson user, but I would actually recommend using a password manager, like KeePass, LastPass, 1Password, whatever. And the thing is, you can actually store your password reset questions in there as well. As bogus as they are, you can, if it says, what elementary school did you go to, you can say Beverly Hills High School. It's not like you're applying for a car loan and actually have to be honest with this stuff. You could just put some random string in there and it's not going to check. It doesn't care. That's basically their due diligence, if you will. So honestly, you know, that's just another reason to use a password manager, but, you know, we can kind of bypass that conversation, because I think that horse has been beaten to death several times on this podcast as well.
Well, all I just want to say, so lastly, I mean, I think our audience is mostly security pros. So to speak to that audience is, you know, from someone who's still dealing with this on somewhat of a newbie level, is just, you know, have patience, you know, have patience with people that, you know, this is a very scary topic to someone who's not in this world. And I, you know, I've spoken on, the last time I was on your podcast, I told you about some stories from friends or family or whomever, some, you know, crazy perceptions they had, right, of security. I told some stories about that, you know, that we laugh at as, you know, security type people. But those are, like, really real thoughts that people think, that they disregard, you know, the stuff that makes sense to us. A lot of them disregard what we're saying because they think it sounds false or fantastical, or that it's just so complicated that it's overwhelming, and they think that they'd rather just take the chance because what we're trying to tell them is too complicated. So have patience, keep it simple. Try to explain these things to people. I had the brainstorm the other day that, you know, the easiest way to introduce someone to a password manager is to share a password with them. You know, just stay with me. I know you're probably like, what? Share a password with them using, say, LastPass, for example, because you can create a free account on LastPass and share something. And even if it's something, or, you know, or even if it's just like a dummy, you know, password, just to show them like the interface to see how it works. I think that's a more user-friendly way than just to say to them, go sign up for a password manager. And they're looking at this going, what? But if you, because it's all very intimidating. But if you start with that tiny step of, they get an email going, so-and-so has shared a password with you. And maybe you tell them ahead of time of like, okay, I'm just going to put gobbledygook in there and it's not really going to do anything, but I just want to show you how easy it is to set up your free LastPass account and to, you know, retrieve that and how you can do that. So, you know, again, I know it's time consuming. I know I can hear people rolling their eyes, but it's how you're going to get people into this, because just telling them to do something and then just having them look at this site going, I don't understand this, it's going to turn them off. And then the alternative is that they're going to be insecure, and then they're going to come to you when, you know, something bad happens. So if you kind of, slow and steady wins the race. If you kind of do it slowly and get them into it, then I think it's going to be more responsive than if you just try to direct them to a site and be like, you know, washing your hands like, okay, I did my part. I know.
Absolutely, no, you're absolutely correct. And, you know, I don't want to get into the John Oliver discussion with Edward Snowden, but you have to find something to make it relatable. John Oliver talked about genital pictures, and that's the last mention of that. You make it relatable to someone, and once they have a vested interest in it, they're going to be a little bit more apt to at least hear you out. So you have that perspective going on. You know, you explain to them the damages, and, you know, it might even be worthwhile to show them haveibeenpwned.com. Really. But, you know, I'm going to share a funny story with you and shamelessly plug myself at the same time. So I wrote a couple of blog posts for my employer. They're linked in the show notes. They're about holiday shopping seasons. But with regards to that, I gave general advice on how to be secure. One was talking about not using public Wi-Fi, having strong passwords, using HTTPS, beware of general phishing stuff. The second one was, okay, this is some pretty hardcore scamming, here's some phishing, and so on. It even went as far as I was interviewed by the investigative journalist on one of the Knoxville, Tennessee news stations, and it went live on the 5 o'clock show just before Thanksgiving, if I recall correctly. So, you know, with that, the funny story that goes along with it, I'm going to keep this as anonymous as possible. Somebody that I know was talking to a coworker about it, and the coworker was bragging that, hey, I don't have to pay for internet. I can go to Starbucks, Panera, anywhere, and use their Wi-Fi to do everything I need to do on the internet. And the person that I know was like, hey, did you not watch his thing on the news? That's not a good idea. And this person, they work in the medical field. They're not a doctor, but I'm going to leave it at that to keep it anonymous. Their response was, oh, I have a password. Nobody can hack me.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the attitude that a lot of people have. And yeah, it's frustrating. And in some cases, I think some people, unfortunately, need to have something bad happen in order to get the message across. And not that I wish that on someone, but yeah, you're not gonna win every battle.
And that's the only way to make some people learn, though, honestly.
No, it is. And if I had more tech skills, believe me, there's a lot of people I'd love to do that, just to get them to listen to me. But yeah, it's difficult. It's, you know, I apologize if I told the story on the last podcast that I did with you, but, you know, when I was early on interested in security, a seasoned professional said to me, you know, that there was a couple things I had to accept in order to, you know, to be in security. And, you know, one of them was, you have to accept that it's, you know, basically a Sisyphean task. You know, I mean, the story of Sisyphus, of trying to, you know, roll the boulder uphill and not succeeding. That's what all this is, you know, really. It's especially this part we're talking about the awareness. You know, unfortunately, yeah, it's just going to be this boulder pushing uphill and hoping that some people listen to the advice and take the advice. But yeah, I mean, there's only so much we can do, and it is frustrating. But I also don't think that, you know, shaming users is good either. I think there's a difference between, you know, venting among professionals and publicly shaming users. So I think that there's a way that professionals can kind of, you know, vent the frustrations. But I think if it turns into this whole, like, you know, if a professional is publicly, you know, shame users for not following instructions, then that turns into this whole, like, us versus them thing, and that's
absolutely,
you know, that's not good to get away, you know, message across or anything. But I think I've just accepted that as my fate, as wanting to get involved with security, that, you know, there's going to be people that are not going to believe you. And honestly, I'm used to that a little bit from being a librarian, just even with, like, facts.
Oh, of course.
You know, I did a lot of research as a librarian. If somebody would say something, I'm like, well, you know, that's not correct because I did this research practice and blah, blah, blah. And people are like, no, my cousin told me that. I still think
it's true. I saw it on the internet. It must be true.
Yeah. It's just, it is our burden in life that we will have people not listen to security common sense. But all we can do is tell them and hope, you know, and hope that they protect themselves. But, you know, for some people, it'll be a longer journey than others. And the easier, you know, that security professionals make it for people, you know, I think the better. And, I have a great story to tell. It's also the younger that you educate people, the better. I posted this on social media. I took out any identifying information, and I received permission from the person to do so. But someone I know has two small children. She posted this, and like I said, I asked her if it was okay to share it, and I have permission. So the story is, without any identifying information, she was helping her older son with his homework, and his school gave them iPads for school purposes. So she picked up his iPad, and she said, you know, what's your password, you know, for your school iPad? And the younger child screamed, no, don't do it. Don't give away your private information. And the older child ran over to her, you know, snatched the iPad out of her hands, secretly put in the password, and then gave it back to her. And when she posted this on social media, she posted it with the context of, well, I guess I can't be trusted. And I swept in and said, no, you're looking at this entirely wrong. I'm like, to me, I'm like, the next time I see your kids, I'm going to give them high fives. I'm like, that's exactly, you know, the perspective that they should have. And I'm like, I know that you as a mother, you know, feel differently, and that's probably a slippery slope there. I'm like, but no, like, please take this as a good thing that they're learning at such a young age, the value of personal information, the value of passwords, and things like that. So I was trying to assure her, and I made my comments public so that the, you know, the other people seeing this post would feel the same way as well, as to instill that. So I've yet to run into those children, but I do intend on giving them high fives and praising them for their, you know, their privacy knowledge. I just think that's great. I mean, we're talking about young elementary school children who have learned that lesson already about the value of keeping a password private. So I was like, good for you, kids. Good for you. So that's how things are going to change, is the younger that we start teaching these concepts and principles, the more it'll start to catch on within a family, and as they grow into adults, will change. So that's my thoughts about that.
Oh, absolutely. If I could get college students, specifically my college students, to stop posting things publicly to Facebook all the time, I would consider that a victory. But, you know, just to wind this segment down, there's just a couple things I want to add. You know, back to your training philosophy, I'm not a fan of punitive measures. So if someone willfully does something wrong, by all means, be punitive. But if someone clicks the fish because it was convincing or you didn't train them, it should not be punitive. Alternatively, I'm a fan of gamifying detection. I will encourage people running security programs to educate their users as good as possible and as frequently as possible, and then make a game out of it. Hey, you know, if you spot a phishing email that I've not seen before, you get 10 minutes off, but the caveat is you have to do that 6 times before you can take it. We'll only do it in hour increments. Yeah. You could get some employee that wants a lot of time off and don't want to use their vacation time that's going to get purposely put on a phishing list, and you handle that differently. You know, we learned a lot about gamifying things from Wells Fargo. So, you know, that's basically all I have to say about that. With regards to the relatability aspect of it, I would easily say, hey, you know, apply the Zen of Python. I say this all the time. Simple is better than complex, and complex is better than complicated. If you can keep it as, you don't want it to be complicated, period. And if you have the opportunity to keep it simple over complex, by all means do so.
Yeah, I think that there's a real Zen attitude that cybersecurity professionals can adopt. And I want to just briefly relate a story that Swift on Security mentioned. It was a couple months ago, I think. There was somebody clicked a malicious link that wreaked all kinds of havoc.
Darn you, Jerry Bell.
Yeah, exactly. Within Swift on Security's place of employment. And the series of tweets went like this was, you know, it was, I won't go into the specifics. It was just, it wreaked all kinds of havoc. It was pretty bad. But the point that I'm getting at is that Swift on Security tweeted that, spoke to the user who clicked on it, and the explanation was the user was anxiously waiting for a FedEx package from their child, and the fish that came in was some sort of FedEx link, and basically I think the child was like in the military abroad, like overseas. It was some like something that like the parent was very like anxious and very emotional waiting for this FedEx package, and they got this, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to pick on FedEx, it could have been UPS, but whatever, the delivery service, was waiting for a specific delivery service. The fish happened to be the specific delivery service. They clicked on it. It was this malicious link. And anyway, long story short, the Zen approach was the tweet that I will never forget that Swift on Security put out there said, you know, after hearing the person's story and talking to them, Swift on Security's response was, I understand. And to me, that was just so powerful. And then there was a couple more tweets after that kind of talking about that. But it was, you know, I understand. You know, you were anxiously awaiting this package. This email happened to come in. You know, it's unfortunate that this happened, but I understand. So that was very powerful to me that Swift on Security relayed that story and then, you know, related that very just Zen response, you know, and I just felt that that was just very powerful. And I just think it's something that, you know, again, don't chastise the person because, you know, what good is that going to do now? Exactly. But I understand. It's been, you know, it had been remediated. They know for next time. But I just had to tell that story because I just felt like that was, you know, that was just a very you know, beautiful ending to a really crazy story of how this malicious link had just, you know, had just taken over the system. So a deep breath. I understand. Zen-like approach.
Exactly, and that's very commendable. You know, I'm not going to get into any of my social engineering adventures as of late right now, but I will say that when you have people who fall for it, you don't typically call them out by name. It's more by title. But when you have someone that you throw everything in the kitchen sink at and they still persist to the script or what have you, you call them out and commend them by name because people need those that type of kudos to justify what they're doing so that they know that they weren't just a complete terrible person for not letting the social engineer do whatever it is they were trying to do. And, you know, to close out this segment, I just want to bellyache for just a moment. So these stories were from Forbes, and I went to the Forbes website. I had my ad blocker on, and Forbes made me turn it off to be able to even view the stuff. I understand that they've got to make some money, but at the same time, I don't want to see a bunch of ads either. Go a little bit lighter on the ads, and don't persecute those of us who choose not to, who choose to use ad blockers. I mean, there's too much malware floating around in ads in this day and age to be fine with accepting ads.
Joe, sweet Joe, who do you think writes these stories? How do you think they get paid? Do you think they get paid in unicorns and leprechauns? The publishers need money, and that is what you need to do to see the article that they're putting out there for free.
I don't disagree, and I understand where it's coming from. It wasn't Forbes, but there is a site that I go to. It's, you know, it's like it's a special interest website. It has nothing to do with information security. You go to it, and yes, if you're running an ad blocker on it, they have 70 something ads per page. And the problem is other sites are doing it as well. And, you know, I understand they've got to make their money. I fully understand that. But at the same time, you know, there are other alternatives as well.
Well, what I disagree with is something like Hulu, where you pay for the subscription and yet you still see ads. That's not okay. If it's one or the other. But if I am accessing material for free, I understand that part of the deal is that you need to see an ad. And most often I find is that you can easily click through an ad pretty quickly, so it really doesn't bother me much. What annoys me is if I tweet an article and someone said, you know, replies to me about, like, you know, oh, it's behind a paywall, or oh, there's an ad blocker. I've actually had people reply to me if I've tweeted a Forbes article complaining about, well, I can't see it because I use an ad blocker. Why is that my problem? I'm tweeting something out there. Like, I don't care that you can't see it. Like, why are you telling me this? It's not my problem. I don't care. I'm not. And now, it's one thing if I do believe that if you are going to tweet something that has a paywall, that you indicate that, because, you know, I might subscribe to something that other people don't. I'm fine with tweeting something that's behind a paywall, as long as you put the little dollar sign so people know, like, oh, that's a paywall thing. Because again, if I know that I subscribe to that or can get access to that through some other database, then I know to do that. But don't tweet back at me if I tweet something from Forbes that you can't see it because of your ad blocker software. I don't care. I don't care.
And that makes perfect sense. With on that note, let's go ahead and take a break. And when we come back, we'll continue the conversation. Sit tight.
Are you looking for a place to advertise to the unique audience of IT security professionals and enthusiasts? Look no further. Advanced Persistent Security is seeking sponsors. This slot could be yours. Contact sales at advancedpersistentsecurity.net for more information.
And we're back from the break. Thank you for sticking around. Just to have a little fun with you, we've decided that we're not going to talk about OSINT this time. Since it is the holiday season, Hanukkah's around the corner, you've got Christmas, Kwanzaa, and we can't forget Festivus. So, with this segment being your idea, Tracy, fill us in.
Well, I saw this great article written by the wonderful Violet Blue. It was posted to Engadget, and the article's entitled, Six Gifts for Your Paranoid Friends and Family. And I posted this to my Facebook page with the not-so-subtle hint of, this is what I would like.
So if anyone is interested in purchasing this for Tracy, email podcast at advancedpersistentsecurity.net and we'll see what we can do.
Don't give out my home address. Have them send it to you and then I'll get it for you. Well, the first thing on the list is the YubiKey, which I actually already have because they gave them away at the O'Reilly Security Conference. The YubiKey folks were there and I have one already, so I can check that off my list. So I was excited. But Joe, you saw something on this list that you were excited about. It was the USB condom.
Yes. They call it the DataBlock USB. It runs for about $8. And basically what it does is you can connect your USB devices to it, and then it will plug into the wall or the USB outlet or whatever. And basically what it does is it prevents whatever you're connecting to from making the data connection. So, in essence, what it's doing is it's preventing anybody from embedding any Raspberry Pis, Pi Zeros, Arduinos, or whatever in lamps or in headboards in hotels. So when you plug that USB device in, they can't sync your stuff for you. It's charging only. If you travel, you need like five of these.
Exactly, yeah, and that's by PortaPal. And that's the DataBlock USB, and they also have the PortaPal micro USB cable. And they're relatively inexpensive. The USB is, like you said, about $8. The cable's about $12. The next thing on the list is very cool. I have something like this. This is the RFID blocking wallet for about $15 up. This one's a stainless steel. It kind of looks like chainmail, wouldn't you think?
I tend to agree.
If you're looking at the photo.
Somewhere between chainmail and denim.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of looks like that. It's not fashionable, but safe over fashion. Yeah, it looks good, but I don't have that exact one, but I have a variation because traveling a lot, I think it's just safe. Passports, all that stuff to put
Absolutely.
All those in there. Now this next one I'm going to need some help with. I'm not entirely sure what this is. The Blink MK2. Do you know what that is?
So, in reading about it, I kind of know about it, but I'm going to throw a subtle little joke in here really quick. I'll see if you pick up on it. So, listeners here on Advanced Persistent QVC, we only have 599,000 of these left in stock. You know, you need to make that call now. Grandma needs this as a gift so she can understand if she's being mentioned on Twitter. So, in essence, you know, all jokes aside with Advanced Persistent QVC, all that aside, basically what happens is you set it up as a trigger, right? It's an LED indicator. You tell it different colors and patterns depending on what you've set it to do. So if, you know, in the middle of the night, your computer starts, you know, getting a lot of activity, a lot of data usage in terms of processing power, RAM, whatever, and it's not necessarily time for an update, this starts to blink. You get mentioned on Twitter. It blinks. Someone posts to Facebook that you're running OSINT on. I knew I was going to wiggle it in somewhere. It blinks. So, you know, this is kind of where I would see the foray between Paranoid and an investor in Reynolds Wrap, because they buy a lot of foil.
Gotcha. So maybe for the more hardcore interested among us, to say it nicer.
That could be the case. And, you know, alternatively, I just thought of another use of it. Like, if you're a pen tester and you're waiting for a process to complete, you could always use that to be able to walk away and say, hey, this is it's done, so here you go. That's always something cool as well. I mean, you know, all jokes aside, I mean, it's an excellent tool for if you're into that thing. I like the surprise of waking up first thing in the morning and seeing how many Facebook and Twitter notifications I have, but that's just me personally.
No, I like that too. Yeah, so I don't really, I mean, you already get notified about Twitter, so I'm not really sure I understand what that the point of that thing is, but...
Well, if you have it on a computer and you don't have Twitter configured to give you desktop notifications, then it can do it. Is how I read it. You know, obviously I don't use it, so I don't know.
Yeah.
But it looks like something that could be of use.
Yeah. So, moving on, the tool with the three O's, emergency lockpick card for $30. And I tweeted something recently that was interesting. It was lockpick laws in the U.S., and apparently Tennessee is a state where lockpick tools are illegal under all circumstances.
I'm not 100% sure on that. And, you know, I go to some conferences. I've ran a lot. I've had a lot of good conversation with some of the guys from Augusta Lock Sports. And, you know, I've really just never got into lockpicking yet. That's not to say I won't, but with that being said, yeah, I mean, Tennessee is so far ahead of the curve on some things. Like, for example, their data breach notification law is actually unique in the fact that it requires companies to notify if encrypted data has been stolen. So, because Tennessee recognizes that that data could be decrypted. With that being said, though, we have laws like this, and then the county that they make Jack Daniels in, Jack Daniels whiskey
is a dry county.
Still a dry county. So they are still behind the times on a lot of things. And, like, truth be told, my home county in Tennessee, they just started selling wine in grocery stores in July.
Oh, well, I'm in Pennsylvania, so I understand. Yeah, we just got wine, like, last week in the supermarket, and that blew my mind. I thought that I was having a stroke because I never thought I'd live to see the day that I could get wine in a supermarket in Pennsylvania that was just, like, out there, like, out next to the buffet bar. It was very crazy. But back to the lockpicking thing, Tool, the organization, has lockpick laws of the U.S., has a nice little map, color-coded map, and Tennessee is the only one in orange, which means lockpicks are considerably restricted under current law. So, yeah, so life is a little different there. I posted something similar on Twitter recently, and I posed the question of, so does that mean that there's no lockpick villages at security cons in Tennessee? And nobody could really answer that, but I guess that would be the case if it's not legal.
I can speak to one single conference in Tennessee that I've attended, and that is besides Knoxville, there was not a lockpick village. But Tennessee also hosts Sword and Shield's Edge Conference, not to be confused with Tactical Edge, as well as Freak Nick and Skydog Con. I don't know about those two, whether they do it or not.
Here we go. I scrolled down. It said use and demonstration of lockpicks. It might be considered legal if not done for profit in Tennessee. So I think that's probably a gray area, because if you paid to get into the con, then the, you know, it depends, I guess, on how
absolutely
much they, yeah. So it's probably just safer not to have any. But yeah, that's interesting. So Tennessee has the strictest lockpicking rules in the nation. So congratulations, I guess.
I suppose, but, you know, with that, there's also a caveat. If you're licensed, you can do it. And, you know, to be entirely honest, growing up, anytime somebody got locked out of their car, here came their uncle in their pickup truck with a coat hanger.
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, obviously, if you're licensed, that's one thing. And then, yeah, I was actually retelling the story last month to a friend that I used a coat hanger to open up his car. And, yeah, it's just, you know, it's a skill that you kind of just have to have.
Funny story before we move on, actually, about people getting locked out of their cars. I was Black Friday shopping in the evening of Black Friday here in the Atlanta metro area. And I had been at a store, and then I go around the corner because I was trying to buy some cologne, and the store I was at had terrible customer service, and I was like, you're not getting my commission. So I go around the corner to buy it at Ulta. What do I see besides two cop cars in front of a store? I was like, man, somebody did something stupid. Nope. Well, someone did do something kind of stupid. One of the cops had locked their keys in the car, and the other cop was having to Slim Jim the door open.
Awesome.
I wanted to take a picture so bad, but this is...
I don't think they'd appreciate
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Yeah. This is the same county that the chief of police instructs all officers to ask anyone they pull over to show them their phone, knowing that the people don't have to do so, but they still instruct them to ask. So, yeah, I didn't want to rock that boat too much, but let's go ahead and continue.
Oh, well, if I can just tell my quick car lockpick story real quick.
Sure.
So last month I was in Prague for a conference, and I met up with an old friend of mine. He lives in Hungary, and we were swapping stories from our past and things like that. And I reminded him about the time that he locked the keys in his car when we went to go visit a museum and how I saved the day. So we went to this museum, we go back to his car, and I don't know how well you know cars, Joe, but do you know what a Škoda is?
Sounds complicated, but no.
No, it was just, it was like barely above a riding lawnmower. It was a... It was really like a, you know, like a late 80s, early 90s era Eastern European car. And so we go back to the car after the museum, lock the keys in the car, and he's, you know, freaking out. And just real calm, I was like, I said, wasn't there a cloakroom at the museum? And he's looking at me like I'm nuts, and he's like, what does that have to do with anything? I'm just, was there a coat closet in the museum? Like, I think I remember seeing one. And he's like, yeah, I think so. Why? And I said, go ask them if they have a wire hanger, because we were in Hungary, so I needed him to go talk. I said, go ask them for a wire hanger. And I'm like, just go get it. So he brought it back, and I said, I'm like, did you ask them if I can ruin this? And he's like, whatever. So anyway, so I did my thing. I unbent it, blah, 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 went in, unlocked the door, and somebody from the museum was there by then, like, you know, watching us. And the two guys stood there in amazement. And my friend turned to the other one, and he said in Hungarian, he said something like, you know, he's like, leave it to the Americans to know how to do stuff like this. And then he told me what he said, and I was like, isn't this like a worldwide skill? I'm like, this has nothing to do with me being American. I'm like, yes, I'm resourceful. Fine, that's it. So, yeah, so I saved the day with knowing a very basic lockpicking skill.
And that's all the more reason that everyone should learn something. But, you know, those pesky Americans. So let's go ahead and move on to the next tool. The next gift. I'll go ahead and kind of kick it off. You know, there's a huge movement right now to use Raspberry Pis, and there's a huge movement to use Tor. So now they've combined this in, for only $69, an onion pie. So basically what it is like Tor in a box, right? So it's a Raspberry Pi that is somewhat hardened that has Tor running on it with a wireless access point. So do you have anything to add with that?
I have a Raspberry Pi that I still haven't taken out of the box. So this would not be a good gift for me, by the way. I don't know. I hear a lot of pros and cons about Tor. I see a lot of people advocating... for use for it. You know, I see a lot of UK people, you know, with their, you know, their new snooping charter passed, telling people to use Tor. But then I also see seasoned InfoSec people, you know, saying that Tor is a waste of time and not as secure, you know, it's not what you think it is. And honestly, I'm a little confused. So is there anything you can enlighten me on?
Well, I've heard a lot of static that the FBI has somewhere in the ballpark of like 8,000 Tor exit nodes, which I don't know any validity to that. I have no back story on it. I do know that, you know, Tor was developed by the Navy. So Yes. Well, here's the cool thing. There's an alternative now called Riffle. And it's it was created at MIT, which you may know Ron Rivest is a professor there. So, you know, there's always that. You can look at it. I don't know a whole lot of information about Riffle aside from its existence. I'll link it in the show notes just to be safe if anyone wants to take a look. But that's definitely a possibility. A question I would have with this Raspberry Pi getup is, you know, most Raspberry Pis run Raspbian. Would it be possible with this to run something like, say, Tails or Cubes, you know, for the ultra-privacy conscious person?
And I just know that an onion pie sounds delicious, to be honest, so I think that'd be
I don't know. I had hibachi earlier, so I've had my fill of onions, and I had my fill of pie last week, so, you know, I might have to abstain from this one.
Yeah, so that's the end of the gifts that Violet Blue recommended. There's all kinds of other sites out there that go into, you know, depth. You know, there's very, very high level gifts you can give. But one thing that I wanted to mention is, unfortunately, I keep seeing this popping up places, and usually where I see it is somebody making fun of it, but this exists in the world, that companies are selling notebooks that are being called, like, you know, your online password notebook. And they're usually sold, you know, like at the, you know, at the counter as like an impulse buy. And I will assume that the target audience for that is perhaps, you know, older people using the internet so that they can write down their passwords.
I have actually seen that in the bookstore, and the price is usually $6.98 at Barnes & Noble. That's a notable number for me because when I was in the Navy, I was on USS Bremerton SSN 698, you know, submarine. So, you know, that number always sticks out. I actually have a picture. I'll put it in the show notes. It was pretty funny because I took a picture of it and I posted laughing about it. And people were like, what are you laughing at? There's nothing funny about this.
Yeah, then, like when I see it, it's because someone is making fun of it. So I'll say this, that I have heard, you know, reputable InfoSec people say that in some instances, writing it down is not a bad thing if you're in absolute control of your environment and how many people, you know, of your physical environment and how many people can say that. So I think the person used it in context of, you know,
exactly.
He has his mother, you know, use a diary to write her things down because she only has logins for a couple sites. And he's instructed her to always lock it in the top of her desk or something. Like, it was someone that I respect. And he's just like, for that one instance where he knew that the physical environment was absolutely secure. But otherwise, I would not encourage people to just write down passwords and have it in a book somewhere. So if you're thinking about getting that for someone as a gift who's not very tech savvy, I would advise against it. Instead, I would say, like, here's a coupon for an hour of my non-judgmental time to show you how to use a password manager.
Absolutely. But, you know, if the general home user could probably benefit from it, I'm going to be honest, flame me on Twitter all you want, but for the general home user, it may be decent. For a work environment, probably not, because your ability to lock things and have exclusive use of the key is minimal. The cleaning crew, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying, is that, yeah, there are some situations where, you know, that it does make sense, and it would be, yeah, it would be strictly a home environment where someone, you know, didn't have a lot of, you know, visitors or people going in and out, or, you know, just a tight control of their physical environment. I would say there are, but unfortunately, I don't think that all people understand whether or not their physical environment is secure to use it, or they decide to keep it in their purse because they think that's a good place, you know, that's a safe place to keep something like that.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, if I were going to use it in a home scenario, I have a FireSafe lockbox, and I would probably keep it in that, and I would only keep certain passwords in it. I wouldn't keep, like, my Gmail password in it, because obviously that's in my password manager. But if I didn't use a password manager, then, yeah. And, you know, it can actually do wonders for preventing password reuse. you know, to find the bright side.
Yeah, the only scenario that I can think of that would really be acceptable, and can feel free to disagree with me on this or not, but if someone wanted to put it in, like, write things down in the event of their death, and then they keep it in a safety deposit box, like a safe deposit box. So maybe if it's like a parent or something, because based on my, you know, own scenario, when my mother passed away unexpectedly many years ago, she did have a lot of, you know, websites and things that she was on. She had a notebook that where she kept things. Now the passwords were kind of buried in the notebook, but we found it, you know, we found this notebook in her desk and kind of started flipping through it. And there were like other things in there. There was just like random lists and notes and things, and kind of somewhere buried in the middle, we found these pages with passwords. So that was actually very helpful. So I don't know, would you agree with that? If someone wanted to use it as like a legacy sort of thing, but they kept it in a safe deposit box, would that be a good use for it?
Oh, absolutely. That's a perfect use case scenario. And, you know, to finalize this segment, flip the script and get a little social engineering in. Here's another perfect scenario for one of those books. You fill it up with a bunch of passwords, and then you just happen to have a few to some malicious accounts, and you just like dropping USB drives, you drop that out and just let someone pick it up. And not necessarily, because it's basically saying, hey, you know what, if you find one of these books laying on the ground, pick it up and destroy it. Don't go pilfering through it and try to log on, because you might get a lot more than you bargained for.
We're supposed to make things easier for people. That's making it more complicated.
Right, yeah. I mean...
Yeah. Now, okay, I see what you mean. But yes, if in the nice instance you just want to help a parent out that is maybe trying to set up some, you know, I can't think of like a nice way to say any of this, but, you know, like they're passing on, you know, they're...
Some people nowadays are even putting some passwords in their will, from what I've heard. But, you know, nonetheless, I agree 100% with your analysis on it in terms of a legacy, something in a safe deposit box, because it's a controlled environment. You know, certain requirements have to be met to be able to get into it. So, yeah, absolutely, I agree. I just had to throw that little nefarious hint in there because, well, that's...
Because you're you, yes. But if you want to hear a real professional talk about this, get a hold of, I think it's on YouTube, our friend Andrew Lurg, Lurg is his Twitter handle. Andrew Callett, who is at Lurg on Twitter, part of the Defensive Sec dynamic duo, he did a great ShmooCon presentation this year about, I believe it was called Online No One Knows You're Dead, and there's a longer story to it, but in essence, it's about dealing with the online presence of someone after they've passed, and the scenarios of when you do and you don't have access to their accounts. So to kind of wrap all this up together, that's a great resource if this is something that you're looking into.
Absolutely. And, you know, the final piece of like anecdote I have here is I had a friend that committed suicide just over a year ago. And for the longest, her husband was logging into her Facebook and just browsing around before it turned into a memorial page. It was just so creepy to log on and see that, you know, air quotes, she was online. I was like, oh, this is so weird, because we know she's not. And then, you know, once we realized what was going on, I was like, oh, okay. So, yeah. But with that being said, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to discuss some potential gifts for you to give your friends to make their friends paranoid. Stay tuned.
Are you subscribed to this podcast? If not, please do so on iTunes and at advancedpersistentsecurity.net/podcast.
Attention listeners, have you ever been interested in recording a podcast of your own, whether it be information security, technology, cooking, or even flags? Look no further. Zencastr is here. Zencastr is a cloud-based online solution that provides each guest with a separate track. WAV files, built-in voiceover IP, cloud drive integration, automatic post-production, and a soundboard for live editing. If you are interested, go to zencastr.com, Zencastr.com, and enter coupon code APSPODCAST20 for a 20% discount. Once again, that is Zencastr, ZENCASTR.com. I hope to listen to you soon. And we're back. So we've talked about Bletchley Park reopening. We've talked about some cybersecurity and phishing advice. We've suggested 6 gifts for your paranoid friend based on some work by the awesome Violet Blue. So now I'm going to shift gears and we're going to talk about things along the lines of gifts you could get the cybersecurity professional in your life to help make their friends more paranoid. So all of these tools are on hackshop.com. They are Hack 5 filled kits. They have all sorts of goodies. There's only 4 products total, so I'm going to kind of breeze through them. Some of these may sound or look familiar from Mr. Robot. So with it, the first one, it is normally about $100. It's on sale for $79. It's a long-range Wi-Fi field kit. So basically what it does, it allows you to transmit your Wi-Fi up to 4 watts omnidirectionally, point-to-point or multi-point Wi-Fi links. With that, you also get some signal boosters, some directional panels, and a Wi-Fi radio. So where could you use this? Well, it's always a good time for an evil twin. So if you're going to do that kind of thing, this is a good tool to use for that. Or if you just want to extend your Wi-Fi, if you're, if that special information security professional in your life wants to hack the Wi-Fi of another building, this might be something they need. But they also need to get out of jail free card as well. So the next tool is called the Hack 5 Essentials Field Kit. It is typically $230, on sale for $199. This is Mr. Robot stuff through and through. It contains a rubber ducky, it contains a Wi-Fi pineapple nano, and a land turtle. There's another tool in there, but it's just a USB adapter. So there's some accessories associated with it as well. It comes in a case. And, basically the Wi-Fi pineapple allows you to do that evil twin attack. It allows you to set it up, and it's going to scan for open Wi-Fi networks or just Wi-Fi networks, and it's going to start replicating the names. Think DEFCON Wall of Sheep. The rubber ducky poses as a keyboard and allows you to connect and drop all kinds of fun stuff into a system that may have data loss prevention software. The land turtle is a USB device that allows you to connect a network cable and basically create a local area network with that machine, bypassing all of its networking provisions that could potentially slow you down. This is the Essentials Field Kit. Moving up to the next one, it is the Elite Field Kit. It contains everything in the Essentials Field Kit, but it's got some more antenna, some more adapters, and instead of having the Wi-Fi Pineapple Nano, it has the Tetra, which is a higher-end tool. It works a little bit better, and there's more capabilities. And the final tool is the RF Hacking Field Kit. So if you know someone that from the previous segment gets the RFID protection wallet, this right here is a good gadget to use to actually test that wallet out to make sure that it really does prevent people from picking up RFID. With that, you can also mess with some Android stuff and maybe some Bluetooth as well. I'm not really too familiar with this product, but realistically, like I said, all this stuff is available on HackShop, HackShop.com. It's a Hack 5 thing. With that being said, it's good stuff. Hack 5 has exclusive hacking equipment, media. They have their own podcast and good information security training. So, can you think of any other use cases for this type of equipment, Tracy?
I cannot. Other than as a gift for you, I guess.
Actually, I tweeted that if anybody wanted to buy me something for Christmas, that's it. So, if you're interested, email podcast at advancedpersistentsecurity.net and we will make this work. And I will say, I will reiterate, a lot of the stuff you see here was used in Mr. Robot, you know, alongside things like the Pwn phone and the Femtocell. You know, the Wi-Fi pineapple actually acts like a Femtocell of sorts, except Femtocells are for cellular. The Wi-Fi pineapples are for Wi-Fi. That's really your big difference. But since we don't have anything else on this, we're going to go ahead and close out this segment. And when we come back, we are going to shamelessly plug everything, and then we'll say goodbye. Stay tuned.
Don't forget to check out our blog at advancedpersistentsecurity.net/blog. Follow us on Twitter at @ADVPersistentSEC. And follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/advancedpersistentsecurity.
Attention security professionals. Have you been looking for a community of only security experts? Look no further. PeerList is here. PeerList helps you stay on top of the news by creating personalized feeds where you get posts from your community and blogs from top industry bloggers, all customized to your specific interests. No more email lists to discuss a topic with other experts. You can invite specific people to any discussion, as well as contribute to any discussion on PeerList. Build your reputation by creating a profile and contributing content that will help others see your expertise. The better your content is, the higher you rank. PeerList never gives your information to any vendor. You are not a lead. You are a professional. Check out PeerList today at peerlist.com. PeerList.com.
And we're back. This is our final segment. So far, we've talked about the fires in the Great Smoky Mountains. We've talked about Bletchley Park reopening, cybersecurity and phishing advice, gifts for a paranoid friend, gifts to make the recipient's friends paranoid, and now we're at the end. So at this time, we're going to talk a little bit about speaking, events, things along those lines. Then Tracy's going to plug everything that she has to plug, and then I'll tell you about some blogs and stuff I've been doing recently. So the floor is yours.
Excellent. So I am thrilled to announce that Philadelphia will have its first B-Sides event this coming weekend, December 2nd and 3rd, and I will be speaking at it. The session I'm presenting is entitled Staying Afloat in a Tsunami of Security Information, and what I'll cover in about 40 minutes, 50 minutes, something like that. It'll be a combination of some OSINT tricks of, you know, more advanced social media research. Maybe I'll touch upon a little bit of Google hacking, but my bailiwick is, you know, advanced Twitter, for example. But what I'm also going to talk about is content management. And, you know, I kind of pitched this as, you know, some OSINT tips with content management for busy InfoSec pros. It's a fire hose of information. So I'm going to show you some tricks that I learned as a librarian who had to, you know, sort through information, how to kind of keep it under control and manage it. And, you know, I'm anticipating that the audience will probably know a number of the things that I mention, but I'm anticipating that there's also people there that don't know what I'm talking about. So I'm going to kind of be all over the place to address the needs of the group. So I'm really excited about that. So again, B-Sides Philadelphia, if you want to follow us on Twitter, I will be live tweeting from the event, and the Twitter handle is B-Sides Philly.
B-Sides brotherly love. Come get your cheesesteaks.
Hashtag cheesesteak sec, exactly. And then going down 95 South for a little bit, can look forward to B-Sides Charm, which is in Balmerhun. That's April 29th and 30th, 2017. I went to B-Sides Charm last year and loved it. People are just phenomenal, and their CFP is open. So if you want to go, put it on your calendar if you want to present something. And Joe, did you have anything else to add about B-Sides Charm in Baltimore?
Yeah, actually, we'll let the cat out of the bag. You know, Tracy and I are working on an OSINT talk for it. I'm also working on a 4-hour OSINT training session. Hopefully they'll both get picked up. If the training doesn't get picked up, I hope at least the hour talk will get picked up. You know, it's still a work in progress, but we're hoping to bring some really good OSINT insight to those that are interested. And, you know, additionally, coming to Baltimore, I would be thrilled to eat some crab and, you know, intermingle with, you know, people in the capital area just because, you know, it's a different point of view than what I see here in Georgia or in Tennessee.
Yeah, it's a really good crowd. You know, you're going to get a mix of, you know, government employees, government contractors, private sector, just, you know, really good people, really nice. Yeah, the food in Baltimore is great. You know, a good Maryland crab soup is phenomenal. The Italians part, you know, Italian section of Baltimore, just these, you know, old row homes, like these restaurants you go to, you look like, you know, it's like literally it's like a row home that they turned into a restaurant. And the Inner Harbor is great, just everything about it. So like I said, B-Sides Philly is, you know, going to be phenomenal. You know, we have a lot of stuff planned at Drexel University, and then not too far away here, just down 95, is Baltimore. And yeah, hopefully Joe and I will be presenting. At the very minimum, I'll definitely be volunteering, but hopefully we'll be actually a part of it.
Excellent. And although neither of us will be speaking at it, and it's still to be determined if either of us will be attending, B-Sides Huntsville is coming up as well in Huntsville, Alabama, just to kind of put that out there. You know, I don't want to get too deep into what's going on because, you know, we, in my opinion, we mention this stuff for the purpose of just getting the awareness out there. We're not sponsored to say anything. But, you know, obviously in January, you also have ShmooCon, which only has one C in it. You know, there's a lot of good conferences coming up. So just be on the lookout. If you have the opportunity, especially to attend to B-Sides, they're typically free or cheap to attend. And in that regard, you know, it's a good time to get out, hear some awesome talks. And honestly, Hallway Con is beautiful. In my opinion, I've learned just as much from Hallway Con as I have from listening to some of the talks that I've heard at the various B-Sides.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I would be remiss as a co-host of the PVCSEC podcast if I did not mention Tactical Edge, Latin America's premier information security conference. A date has tentatively been set in mid-September in the city of Medellin, Colombia. This past October, or last month, I should say, last month in Bogota was phenomenal. And Medellin is looking to be even better. So mark your calendars now, mid-September, Medellin, and follow Tactical Edge on Twitter for updates.
Excellent. And, you know, there's always a good possibility that you never know who will pop up there as well. So while we're talking about Edge conferences dealing with security, I have to point out that Sword and Shield Enterprise Security has a conference called Edge Security Conference as well. The tentative dates for it, I believe, are October 17th and 18th. It's in Knoxville, Tennessee. They had Will Overstreet, one of the former University of Tennessee football players, as the MC this year. There was about 300 people that had attended, so it was pretty good turnout. Unfortunately, I didn't get to make it, but it does exist as well. But with that being said, we also have to, as a contractual obligation, and out of our own desire to advance the world around us and venues that we partake in, you should take a listen to the PVC Security Podcast. As Tracy alluded to earlier in the podcast, I'm recording an episode with them tomorrow as the guest, and hopefully we will sing Rocky Top.
Oh, it'll be done. No worries. We just need a second song, so come up with your second Tennessee theme song.
Oh, it's easy. It's the Tennessee Waltz.
That has words?
I think so. I'm going to have to Google that really quick. Let me look.
We'll figure it out later. But while he's looking that up, why don't I plug my company, Sherpa Intelligence? So I created Sherpa Intelligence this year after I quit my illustrious law firm librarian career. And what I can do for you is I can do competitive intelligence research. I can do news monitoring and all kinds of other research. I have clients that I do research for, either news related or subject related or competitive intelligence related. And a new part of my business, Well, and I also do social media management, but then a new emerging sector of my business has been live tweeting events. I have always been known for my Twitter knowledge and prowess, but at Tactical Edge, I really showed how I can live tweet an event and really capture the sessions very well. And if you know, want to go to the Tactical Edge account, you can see that and talk to Edgar Rojas, Silver Fox, on Twitter. But yeah, I've actually had a lot of inquiries from cons and businesses interested in my live tweeting services. So that is what Sherpa Intel is up to for now. And I have some other things, some other irons in the fire that I can't talk about yet, but good things are happening. So get on board the Sherpa Intelligence train while you can.
Excellent. And, you know, a lot of people think about, you know, when they're talking about cons, they're always looking at Iron Geek, Adrian, to do the recording. You know, you and him are like a 1-2 punch. It's vital for any con to have both parties. So that way you have the historical evidence from the videos, and then you also have the historical evidence and a way to garner attention via your live tweeting. So...
And exactly, you know. And what I do also as part of the tweeting service is I use a site called Storify where you can save the tweets and actually reorder them. So what I go back and do is for each session, I go and I order them into Storify, and then people can go to a Storify link for that specific session and see all the tweets in order as they happened. So it reads, like the name sounds, like a story. And I did that for a couple of the Tactical Eds sessions, and I'm still working on some of the other ones, but it's a good way to get a synopsis of that session of all the tweets that happened during it, because I can go in and tell it to search not just Tactical Edge tweets, but anybody who used a certain hashtag, and I can pull them together. So yeah, it's a great way to preserve what happened during that session, especially if you're following from a distance.
Excellent. And I have verified there are lyrics to the Tennessee Waltz. But there's also a bluegrass song called Knoxville Girl. I'm not sure if it's necessarily appropriate. You can take a look at it and decide for yourself. But Rocky Top and the Tennessee Waltz are perfectly fine with me.
All right. Well, we'll discuss later. But yes, we will be sure to make the music Tennessee themed for you tomorrow.
It has to be. We have to do it to rep East Tennessee, you know, right now in this difficult time, to bring whatever glimmer of hope we can find to rally the troops, if you will. And, you know, I don't want to get on the soapbox again too heavily, but again, you know, from the beginning of the show, if you have the means to make any sort of donation, be it time, material, or even money, you know, by all means do so. If you don't have the means to do so, just share it, get the word out there, and help these families in need, especially this time of year. So, with that being said, I'm going to plug a few things that I've been working on lately as well. And I'm going to have links to all this in the show notes. But the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, I did an interview with WATE Channel 6 in Knoxville and their investigative reporter, Don Dare. We discussed holiday shopping safety tips. And from there, you know, we went over some best practices. It shouldn't be anything foreign to anyone in InfoSec. I had a blog post that was published that same week by Tripwire talking about social engineering and what kind of information I can gather from your stick figure families on your cars. Then just today, ITSP Magazine published a blog post about how to prevent your Internet of Things devices from contributing to the next botnet. So that's out there as well. Sword and Shield has published a few of my blog posts about holiday shopping safety as well. There's a few more coming down the line that I really, you know, I'm not sure where they're going to end up, so I'm not going to say too much about them, but just know that they are out there. I've got some more content about to come down the pike with Alien Vault, and, you know, there's just a lot of fun stuff happening. I'm working on the OSINT training. Tracy and I are working on the talk to go in concert with the training. And, you know, that's really kind of about it in terms of what I've been working on right now. With that being said, Tracy, go ahead and give us your parting words of wisdom, and then we'll say goodbye.
Well, have, you know, a safe and secure December while shopping. And, yes, get gifts for ones you love to help keep them safe.
Exactly.
Even if that's a coupon to give them, you know, stress-free, non-judgmental time of, you know, security education. So pretend like you're in kindergarten again, where you give coupons for hugs, give coupons for, you know, some instruction, and help make your friends and family safe.
Exactly. And, you know, the final thing here, I forgot to mention a little bit earlier. I don't know how long these sales are going to be on. I don't even know if they're still on. I took part on a couple of them. You can get a Shodan Life membership for $5 right now. So if you're into Internet of Things and open source intelligence, that's a good place to look. Pastebin is offering a lifetime membership for $25 as well. Great deal. I've just started using ProExpion. It's a really good VPN service. I like it so far. And then a friend of the show, Justin Seitz, his Hunchly, hunch.ly, was offering a Black Friday deal on the Hunchly service as well, which is really good for OSINT collection. You should probably expect to see that again, possibly in a training or a talk. But just know that there's a lot of sales right now. And then O'Reilly, I'm not sure if they still have the deal as well, but you could use code word CYBER16 and get 60% off any digital book to include the upcoming release of InfoSister, Amanda Berlin, the book that she co-authored. So, you know, that's worth taking a look at as well. Go out and support the information security community. Now's a good time to rack up on good deals, and it helps your peers. So, with that being said, until next time, stay secure.
Thank you for listening to the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast. Until next time, stay secure, and don't forget to subscribe to this podcast.